Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A lot is known about how alcohol is made, from the magical qualities of yeast turning into ethanol to the fermentation process and how different sugars and materials affect taste. But despite thousands of years of humans making it and enjoying it, it turns out there's a lot about alcohol that's still totally unknown or poorly understood. My next guest is Adam Rogers. He set out to understand the science of alcohol and wrote a book on it called Proof, The Science of Booze. He's also the articles editor at Wired magazine. So, hi, Adam. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
And I see you start off the book talking about a great bar moment, which is kind of what inspired you to do all this research into the science of alcohol. So, is this a drunk revelation?
I'm going to say no, just because I did find that I had an utter inability to do any kind of writing with even the barest sip of alcohol in me. So it is a soberly written book about some unsober topics.
So much is known about the chemistry and biology behind how alcohol is made, but is part of what attracted you to this the parts of the process and its effects on people that are unknown?
You know, I was actually... that was actually something that came as a bit of a surprise to me while I was doing the reporting. I was attracted to it because I got interested in the research that was being done and interested in some of the history of that science and why those questions had been asked. And then as I dug into it and started to find that there were some real edges, some unknown country out at the edges of what people knew about alcohol, that became more and more of interest to me, because that's what's exciting to scientists, is the questions that they still have. And when it turned out that there were a lot of those about alcohol, that became a place that I could press on and say, well, okay, what don't we know here, and why don't we know it, and what are people trying to do at those edges to figure out the answers to those questions?
So, for example, even though you're a science writer, you seem sort of mystified by the transformation of yeast and the fermentation process. You call it magical a few times. What do you mean by that? Why is that still magical to you with all you know about science?
Well, I'm stealing a little bit kind of intellectually and in a paraphrase rather than a plagiarism from Arthur C. Clarke, right, with the line about any sufficiently advanced technology looks like magic, that because we don't know how it works, and because there's a transformation, because something changes from one thing into another thing in a way that happens in where the naked eye can't see how it works. It's a magic trick, essentially, right? It's a little bit of nature's prestidigitation, and it makes something wondrous. It makes a substance that actually changes the way you feel if you ingest it, which is kind of amazing if you think about it. And the idea for me is that that the more you know about how that process works, in fact, about any process, and this is where the science writer in me comes out, that shouldn't make something less magical, that in fact that should make it seem more magical as we understand the process behind it.
So, listeners, do you have any questions about the science of how alcohol is made, how that affects taste, or how it affects your head, excuse me, or your body? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Are you not quite clear if the hair of the dog is a good hangover cure or not? Or whatever, 212-433-WNYC to ask Adam Rogers, author of Proof, The Science of Booze, 212-433-9692. So here's one. You have why a great pour of beer is so important to the taste. The traditional double dispense of a Guinness, for example. Talk about that.
Well, first of all, I would say that for sure there's theater involved in our perception of how something tastes and how much we enjoy it. And I think that's totally fine. Being in a bar and getting that pour of Guinness that has that beautiful creamy head and the bubbles are doing that magical thing that they do in Guinness where they seem like they're going in the wrong direction. You know, that's all contributes to the experience that you're having, and the perception of that experience will affect how you would assess the quality of what you're drinking. I think all of us have had the experience of trying a great bottle of red wine in some out-of-the-way bistro in Paris, right, and then having the same bottle in front of the television at home watching a rerun of Star Trek. It's not quite the same flavor, right? But then also, you know, bubbles are a way to convey flavor and aroma in champagne when they pop at the top of the surface of the champagne. They're conveying some of the aromatic chemicals that are down in the liquid into your nose. And that light tracery, that lacing of bubbles that's on the side of a beer glass, as you drink it is an indicator for the quality of the beer and the quality of the way they've washed their glassware in a bar, just the way that they've taken care of their product. So in that sense, it's an indicator for deeper quality as you down the pint.
So here's a science question that came in on our Facebook page from Nancy, who writes, how can I avoid getting too tipsy? I try to drink slowly and with food, but I was wondering if some foods are better than others in combating the embarrassing problem of chandelier swinging.
It is a bummer that even if you account for body mass, for size, that women's tolerance for alcohol tends to be less than men's tolerance for alcohol, and that sucks. But it's also true that if you have food in your gut, it slows down the progress of the ethanol, right, which is the psychoactive ingredient in what you're drinking, through your guts and then out into your body and into your brain, where it's going to have the effects, the psychological effects that alcohol can have. So, eating first. It is one of the pieces of advice that they give you that first day before the first weekend in college that actually it's true. Get some food in your stomach. Don't drink on an empty stomach.
So she's asking, are some foods better than others?
Well, I mean, there's not a lot of science there. You know, people talk about fat, having fatty foods in your stomach more than others, or having, the thing about drinking olive oil or something like that to coat the inside of the stomach and the intestines. And there, as far as I know, there's not solid science behind that. It's really just mass, right? It's really just having something in there that slows down the whole process.
How about
No.
So Susan on Facebook asks, can one type of drink, say red wine, affect you differently in terms of things like drowsiness, mood, or a likelihood of getting a hangover than another type, say gin or vodka, she asks, or is it strictly the alcohol content?
This is such a fascinating question, because what it really is asking is, are there other psychoactive chemicals in a drink? And that is not really understood. People do know that in most cases, what's really going on is how much ethanol did you consume, and that's what's having the effect. So, for example, there's some research that suggests that like brown liquor will give you a worse hangover than clear liquor, but the clear liquors, so bourbon versus vodka, but vodka will give you a hangover too, right? Or red wine versus white wine. People say sulfites in red wine give you the headache, but in fact, white wine has sulfites as well. So a lot of what's involved there is placebo and expectancies about what you're going to experience. If you think that tequila makes you angry, but bourbon makes you morose, then that's what reaction you'll have when you drink them. So the science says fundamentally, like, no, it's really just how much ethanol was in there. Were you drinking something high proof or low proof? But there are some hints that things like sulfites or histamines, other stuff that's present in an alcoholic beverage, may actually have some psychoactive effects separately. People haven't done the science. It's just it's tantalizing, the idea that maybe there's something else. But, of course, that's what they used to say about absinthe, right? That's the famous example, is that because absinthe, one of the ingredients in absinthe was wormwood, which had a molecule in it called thujone, which is in large levels a hallucinogen. People thought that if you drank enough absinthe, like the Byronic poets, right, that it would turn you into essentially an epileptic murderer, that you would have seizures and you'd kill people and you would go nuts. And that's why absinthe was banned for so long in Europe and in the United States. But the fact is that when you go back and look at the pre-ban absinthe and you do the study, you do the gas chromatography on it to figure out what's in it is nowhere near enough thujone to have any kind of psychoactive effects, and a ton of ethanol. Like, it was really high-proof stuff, and that's why people were kind of going nuts when they were drinking too much of it.
So all of that, it sounds like all of that equates to, no, it's really just the alcohol content.
Yeah, sorry, I should have looped back around to that and say, like, as far as everybody knows, it's really just how much alcohol. Yeah, that's right.
For my guest, Adam Rogers from Wired Magazine, science writer and author of Proof, The Science of Booze, 212-433-WNYC. And John in Paramus, you're on the air. Hi, John.
I'm strictly a gin drinker, but I wanted to know, is blended whiskey better or worse for you than as pure clear liquors like vodka, gin, and whatnot? I mean, like blended, we have scotch, blended scotches and whatnot.
What do you mean by better or worse for you?
I mean, for your system. The system digested better, tolerated better. Because I've heard that, like, blended whiskeys are really not, are worse for you over the long run, that you should drink, like, pure, clear whiskey, alcohol.
Adam, did you look into that?
Yeah, I mean, no, there's nothing more or less toxic in any of that stuff. I mean, anything that's in a drink that's not ethanol or water, the term for that is a congener, right? It's the other substances. So in a brown liquor, right, you have the pigments, the brown that's coming off of the wood that it's aged in, let's say. And it is true that a vodka is, by law, supposed to be nothing but ethanol and water. But you're talking about gin. So gin already is full of other stuff because it's flavored with all kinds of botanical ingredients, primarily juniper, but also other stuff, cucumber, citrus peel, things like that. So you're already adding things back in. And if they were toxic, you wouldn't be allowed to sell them, you know. So the better for you, like, can you digest it more easily? I mean, nah, you know, you have all of the gear in your tummy to digest all of those things. It's not really... There's not a better or worse. They're going to have the same effect on you primarily. It's really which one do you enjoy the taste of.
John, thank you. Another question coming in on Facebook from Tim. What's the science behind the notion that one drink, one glass of wine or whatever, is heart healthy or has some other medicinal efficacy?
Super controversial, right? If you follow the science behind a chemical called resveratrol, for example, which is found in red wine in roughly higher quantities, but you still find it in some other alcoholic drinks as well. Researchers have gone back and forth as to whether it increases lifespan fundamentally, because it has that effect on some model organisms that people study in labs, and then trying to figure out how that might be the case and what it might do for organisms as complex as you and me. I'm assuming that you and I are complex. That could be a...
I know I'm complex. I can't speak for you.
Fair enough. I won't try to speak for me on that subject. But a lot of the researchers I talked to, enters the realm of hypothesis and speculation, would say that one of the reasons that, like, one glass of red wine might be heart healthy is that it chills you out a little bit, right? The ethanol at that level, which is a low level, makes you more relaxed, less worried, a little bit happier, and these are all seen even in the world of folks who study addiction, dependency, and the things that can really go wrong if you drink too much. Would say, like, those are all good things, right? And they balance away. If you're not drinking much at all, they outweigh the potential negative effects of drinking too much. That's the heart healthy part and the life extending part that the people who study this are kind of circling around agreement on. Whether red wine contains a miracle molecule that if we just took pills full of all the stuff, we would all live to be 300 years old. Controversial, and
nobody knows.
It goes back and forth in the science. Every couple of years, they have a different answer.
Michael in Jericho, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael. Michael, you there? All right, let's try Derek in Manhattan. Hi, Derek, you're on the air.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Is there any synergistic effects when consuming alcohol and tetrahydrocannabinol or THC, which is pot?
Oh, you can answer that question yourself, Derek, can't you?
No. Well, synergistic effect means that it's an enhanced effect. The parts are greater than the sum.
Yeah, well, so let me say this. Ethanol definitely has a synergistic effect with drugs in the class called benzodiazepines, things like Valium, okay, right? So as you say, the sum is greater than the parts. You get more of an effect of both, which is why they'll say don't drink while you're taking a Valium or another benzo in that family.
That can kill you, right? I mean, they warn on the labels
that.
For those medications not to mix them with alcohol.
Exactly. So I didn't look into directly pot and booze, but the mechanisms in the brain are separate enough that they wouldn't have the same kind of synergistic effect. The reason that the benzos and alcohol have a synergistic effect is that they seem to operate on the same or very closely related receptors on the neurons in the brain. So the way neurons in the brain communicate with each other, that's where those chemicals work. Whereas pot. It has a lot of effects, and they're not well understood either, as far as I can tell. But fundamentally, there are endogenous cannabinoid receptors in the brain, right, that respond to THC and other molecules in marijuana that are a separate mechanism than ethanol. So you wouldn't see that kind of synergistic effect. Although, you know, the effects can be similar, so you might get you're at least overloading on the psychoactive chemicals, potentially.
So,
but that's all, I'm speculating. I didn't look into that as a reporter.
Derek, thank you for your call. So what's the mechanism scientifically for the danger of mixing Valium and so forth with alcohol? If they both have the same effect on a part of your brain, as you were saying, why is that dangerous?
Well, notionally, because what you're doing is amplifying that effect to the point where you're having, you know, central nervous system depression. Right, where the anesthetic qualities of both of those different chemicals are getting to the point where they're making it so that you're not able to breathe, right? And that's something that if you consume ethanol in a high enough level, super high levels, like that's what ethanol toxicity is, right? That's alcohol poisoning, where it starts to act like an anesthetic, where you don't feel pain and where eventually you're not breathing. And at high levels, super high levels, it'll be cell toxicity, you know. But that's not getting drunk. That's injecting the stuff, you know. That's a huge level. And so, and because benzodiazepines, as I say, seem to have the thing that's super frustrating here. I mean, I'll just to take a break from that for a second, is that unlike all of the other recreational drugs that human beings use, whatever your sense of legality or morality that is, we use a lot of them. Scientists haven't articulated a mechanism for how ethanol works in the brain. Not a clear one. They've got some ideas. So it's really hard to say, like, well, what's going to happen, you know, if I do this? What's going on in the brain when ethanol's involved? Because the answer's kind of like, well, we're not really sure what's happening in the brain with ethanol. And if you really push hard on that, we're not really sure how the brain works. And we've got a lot of really good ideas, and we know a lot about that, but we still don't have that solved either. So the synergistic effect that you asked about is that some of the candidate receptors for where ethanol has its action in the brain are benzodiazepine receptors. And so they get... You're basically putting too much weight on them to do that work, and so the anesthetics become that much more potent.
My guest is Adam Rogers, author of Proof, The Science of Booze, 212-433-WNYC. And now I think we have Michael in Jericho. Michael, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi. I have a question from your guest. Who actually discovered alcohol? When and who was it? Did he made it, discover it? Where it came from?
Such a great question. So the process of fermentation, the thing that yeast do, right, eating sugar and then excreting carbon dioxide and ethanol, is 150 million years old. So when did human beings first take control of that? Well, the history that people have, the archaeology, the anthropology, and the science, goes back about 10,000 years. The oldest example of human-controlled fermentation is from an archaeological site in China called Jiahu, in a shard of pottery that's 9 or 10,000 years old. This is research by a guy named Patrick McGovern at Penn, where there was some residue on this pot. He did a bunch of science in his lab, a bunch of analytical chemistry, and found evidence of beeswax from honey, rice, probably hawthorn fruit. And if you mix those things together, it's really hard to not get fermentation. Those things sort of want to ferment. It's like the Mother Eve of booze, right? You get honey that makes mead, rice that makes sake, fruit that makes wines and brandies. That's the oldest. It's possible that might push back even farther, but that's the oldest evidence that people have so far. So really, you know, it's not a discovery of ethanol that human beings did, but a taming of the process, a domestication of a process that existed in nature. And that's one of the reasons why I get so hyperbolic about how this is, when we learned how to do that, that's when Homo sapiens became people, because it was us starting to take, control is not the right word because that sounds pretty negative, but it was us starting to understand that there were natural processes that we could make use of and that we could hone to our own ends. And then you don't see distillation until about 8,000 years later, and that's when we start to become engineers, right? We become technologists.
Michael, thank you for your call. By the way, folks, we posted some Adam Rogers approved cocktails that he writes about in the book on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Please drink Adam Rogers approved cocktails responsibly. But along those lines, a lot of your research for the book had you traveling around and tasting all kinds of specially aged spirits or beers made with different strains of yeast. And you couldn't always tell much of a difference between what's supposed to be the good stuff and the regular stuff. So tell us about that, and what does it say about how we taste booze?
Well, so it may say a lot about my palate as well, but when we're tasting and smelling, right, our sense of taste, the straight ahead, you know, salty, sour, sweet, bitter, umami flavors, that's what our tongue does, right? But everything else that's more complicated or more subtle happens in our nose. Basically, little like pieces of our brain really sort of dangle down, neurons kind of dangle down from our brain onto this nasal epithelium, and pieces, small molecules of whatever we're smelling come through the air and land on those neurons. And in some way that's not totally well understood yet, in combination over time in certain places, that's how we get the complicated smells and flavors that we would think of, especially when you're drinking the things like the sort of coconutty flavors of an aged an aged wine or an aged whiskey, or the you know, you get hints of tropical fruits in a Pinot Grigio, you know, something like that, right? So when I was tasting, especially a set of beers where the only thing that this place called White Labs in San Diego, which makes a lot of yeast for craft brewing, the only thing they changed was the yeast, and they made all these beers in the same way. Could I taste differences in them? Yeah, I did taste differences. To me, they were very subtle differences. I think a person who had some training and more experience in tasting a lot of different kinds of beer would have detected more subtleties just because your sense memory gets better. Now, what the science says about how many of those things we can detect and whether we can put names to them is that our ability to taste is a lot, to taste and smell is a lot simpler than what you might read in a magazine that does wine connoisseurship and criticism, let's say. You know, we can hold about four different aromas or flavors in our palates and our brains at one time. So the idea that you can detect 16 or 17 different flavors in, let's say, a glass of wine is probably not true.
Well, we should say before you go that you end the book with hangovers, and it really shouldn't be so surprising by this point in the book, since you've explained that so much of alcohol and how it reacts with humans is poorly understood, that the after effects are also poorly understood. But how is it possible that no pharmaceutical company has struck it rich on a pill or other cure for something that can be so horrible for so many people and seem so run-of-the-mill?
You believe me, when I ask that question of people who are doing this research, I sound even more frustrated than you sound. You should have heard me ask these guys. You got to be kidding me. Are you telling me that, like, no transnational drinks company wants to give you money to figure this out?
Right, where were you in freshman year? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, right. Like, come on, man. Like, hook a brother up, right? Like, you gotta help somebody out here. But and what they would, what the answer is, there's notionally, though nobody would kind of come all the way out and say this, was notionally like, well, if you're working on that, it makes it seem like you're condoning misbehavior. And the fact is, and I feel this much more keenly as I've gotten older, a hangover is a sign that you messed up the night before. You know, like, most of my book takes place at about two sips into the second round. You know, that's the relevant range for me of, like, you feel the effects and you're tasting stuff, but you're still okay. You're still all right. You know, if you're hungover, that means that you went too far.
It's a feedback system. It's our body's way of preventing us from constantly overdoing it on some level.
You would think. You would think.
Although, yeah. At some of our best universities, it's a badge of honor.
Well, right. I mean, what does happen, the feedback system that does work pretty well is if you drink so much of one thing that you throw up, right? Because we're that vomit response is a really good way to train your body to never eat something again. It's why so many people, you know, like bad tequila, right, is the famous example of that. What they do seem to be getting to, the few scientists who study hangovers are finding that it looks like an inflammatory response, but it looks like if you have the flu, let's say, so those aches and the feeling of being kind of slower and dumber, the gut symptoms and the headache symptoms, they look a lot like if you have a bad case of the flu. They also have a lot of interesting symptomatic overlap with migraine. And so then you say to yourself, well, okay, I can get anti-inflammatories over the counter, man. Like, and that, you know, aspirin, acetaminophen, ibuprofen, right? But all of those come with their own symptoms, and a lot of those, if you're taking a lot of them especially, do some of the same bad stuff as a hangover does. So ibuprofen can have some gastrointestinal problems, but if you take a lot of it, you know, you can even have gastrointestinal bleeding, and your GI system's already messed up from the hangover. I should say, too, I'm a journalist, which is like the opposite of being a doctor, so please don't take medical kinds of advice from me. That would be a mistake.
I'm going to sneak in Chuck here, who I think wants to ask about celiacs and alcohol. Is that right, Chuck?
Sure, absolutely. So having dated a woman that had celiac disease and colitis, I was surprised to meet up with her after that period of us dating a year or so later, and she was drinking bourbon, and I was like, wait a second, what are you doing? Doesn't that have gluten in it? And she said, no, if you drink high-end, high-level alcohol through the distillation process, it removes the gluten. And is that actually true and accurate? And
that's not even high-end. I mean, anything distilled, gluten doesn't make it over the top of a still. I mean, people will say different things about that, right? Like, and I might get yelled at about that, but that is what the science says. Gluten does not make it over the top of a still. So if you're especially buying the bourbon that says it's gluten free instead of the other bourbon, the other bourbon doesn't have gluten either.
All right, celiac disease sufferers, there is your Friday night permission pass from Adam Rogers, author of Proof: The Science of Booze. Thank you very much for joining us. This has been great fun.
My pleasure. I'm glad. Thanks for having me.